Okay, it's 8:31. Should we begin, Rabbi?
We shall begin.
Okay, hello everyone. Thank you all for joining us. As always, just let me start some follow-up with some questions and some comments. Rabbi Ari Enkin, I showed you, we saw that video of this guy, this non-Jewish guy. He comes into a house, a Hasidic house, and he videos the Shabbos meals. And I was wondering about this, and Rabbi Enkin emails me that that it's now, this sort of thing is becoming, it's a weak heter, but it's becoming more normative. And he called my attention to something called the Piskei Tshuvos, which really doesn't talk about that per se as a heter. It talks about if the non-Jew does it, on, it seems to be on his own, and if he wants to sell it to the Jews, and that's why he's doing it, is that permissible? It's a machlokes, but to actually bring him in. But on the other hand, of course, if you have it set up and you don't actually invite the non-Jew in, like let's say it's automatic, we have to ask ourselves, what's the isser? Maybe if it's being done automatically. But in terms of it becoming popular, Rabbi Enkin, who, if you don't know him, you can look him up. He's written some very nice halacha works. He says they do it in Uman. So lo and behold, I look up, I go on the internet and I'm trying to find videos of Uman. And first I find this, and this is reason enough why not to go to Uman now, perhaps. In a description of why you should go to Uman from Breslov.org, it explains, I'll just read it to you, the last paragraph. You can read the whole thing if you want. Oops. The Rebbe felt, now the Rebbe is Reb Nachman, that it's the most important thing to be with him in Rosh Hashanah, as Hashem gifted him to understand the essence of Rosh Hashanah as no one else did. He said that he can fix things for people on Rosh Hashanah that no one else can. So Reb Nachman can fix things. And then it says, in that case, even if one feels that the davening in Uman won't be as good for him, or the amenities stink, or the people, or the travel, and discomfort will be challenging for him, he is still best off spending the holiday with the Rebbe, because the Rebbe will make sure to help him take care of what he needs to do with what he needs to with Hashem for the new year. So in other words, you go there and the Rebbe will make sure with God that everything's okay. Now that's, I guess, what you call Doresh HaMesim. But okay, if you're going to go to Uman, this is a video. Took place. Notice they say video by non-Jew, but they hire the non-Jew to take this video. And here you go. So there you go. You got, and I told you, the other Hasidic groups have done this. So I can't say whether this is going to become normative, but it's definitely strange. And like I said, you people can do their bar mitzvahs then automatically. They can set it up. Some people emailed me about the philosophy of the Rambam. I want to call your attention to something, which isn't Torah in motion, but hold on, where it is. About, I don't know what year it was. I think it was 2006. There is something in Canada called KTS-TV, some television there, and they decided to do a whole 13-part series on the Rambam, on his 13 principles. One show about each principle. And it's a bit of a strange thing because they combine it with like a game that these young people are playing. But who they interview on it? Myself. They spent hours and hours at my house because we had to go through all 13 principles. They interviewed, it's from Toronto, they interviewed Rabbi, see some of the videos, I uploaded these all to this thing in Toronto, it used to be called KosherTube. And then I guess that closed down and KosherTube put it on YouTube. But the audio was perfect, the video is not always so. Rabbi Yitzhak Breidowitz, who I don't know, but very good. You have Rabbi, unfortunately, Rabbi Leib Tropper, he had a bit of a scandal after this. David Novak, Sholem Carmi, Rabbi Hecht from Toronto, and I think, and Mayor Schiller. And I have to say, if anyone's interested, it's only, they're about 40 minutes, no, 20 minutes long, each one. And if you cut out the game at the beginning and the end, they're each 15 minutes. And what I find really interesting in this, it's called Credo 13, is even though the you have, let's say, Donovak and myself are the academics. I guess Carmi's in the middle. And then you have the rabbis. With the exception of Tropper, we all say basically the same thing. So I think it's a very good example of where the both the academics and the traditionalists, and I do have to say, I've never met him, but Rabbi Breidowitz from Toronto, he comes across very, very insightful. So anyone who's interested, very nice. Two more things I want to show you. All right, well, one more thing I want to show you, and then I want to read you something, and then we'll be back to where we are. I showed you last class. I couldn't find it. I wanted to show you one more video. But before I do that, I was showing you these videos of the schools, and someone mentioned Rav Avadia permits, if it's not live music, and I sort of agreed, but it's not really true. I misspoke. In fact, it's the responsum that we saw earlier on in the book from his son, where originally Rav Avadia said it's a problem if you know what the woman looks like, but then he retracted and said that's not a problem. The problem is only if you've seen her live. But the son says, and it doesn't matter whether it's Shira Chaya or Bahakata, because look, let's be realistic. If you're watching a video, that's the same thing. So Rav Avadia does not permit to watching, you know, the live shows. So I showed you some of these things. The one I was looking for, just I'll show you quickly here. And I'll stop it. I don't need to show you any more of this, but this takes place, like I said, at one of the yeshiva high schools. Okay, so because someone said they didn't see boys and girls together. Now, after the class, I was thinking, you know, this is my alma mater, JC, and I'm thinking that a lot of these schools would have no problem with these events. But I know, having gone to this school, this isn't the sort of thing JC and certainly the school in Waterbury. So what's going on here? So I spoke to my son, who is one of the organizers, and just so we have it clear, this is a different sort of event, although it's hosted at one of the yeshivas and others were. None of the students, even though they're organized and all the parents come and they have a whole program and they list them by school, it's not like a basketball game where you're in a league and JEC or Frisch has a team, has a school. These are students from the schools. So it's not an official entry, let's say, from JEC or from the other school. So in that sense, it's a little less radical, because you can't really say that all these schools are giving their imprimatur. And maybe some of the schools, if their kids won, they might not even advertise it. So you're going to say, so why don't they shut it down? What are you going to do? You know, you're going to make a big deal about it. You're going to tell the students they can't go. Yeah, if it was a more Haredi school, I guess. But it's a big event, but these are not official entries from the schools. Now, one of you emailed me, so what do I think about it? You know, my son's in it. I told you last class, I'm not crazy about it, because I think they should do Jewish music. The girls singing, they have their post game, they have their halachic justifications. I'm not talking about that. I think the real issue is that, singing the non-Jewish music, getting so into it, that's a culture that's really not our culture. And but it's a never-ending thing. In the 50s, parents didn't like the music the kids listened to. Sports is a bigger problem. The kids get all crazy about these sports things. It's a never-ending issue. That's the issue in the modern Orthodox world. The Haredim have their own issues, but what are you going to do? I'm not the principal. So there you go. Years ago, Young Israel used to actually have dances for the young people, because they wanted them to have, some of you, probably your parents might have met at Young Israel dances. I know someone who told me that his parents met at a Young Israel dance. The idea was that you keep them from going to the clubs and meeting non-Jews or irreligious Jews. So that's part of our history. And finally, I want to read you something from our friend, our Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Aryeh Leib. And this takes us back, just one final comment about the issue with the Kloisenberger Rebbe. And he says as follows, and this will be the last thing we do. While listening in class 35 to your comparison of the Kloisenberger Rebbe to Farrakhan, I never compared them, but I instinctively felt that there was a difference, but couldn't verbalize it. From your comment in the last class, I realized that others were disturbed by it, and you were aware of that, but nevertheless, you still couldn't verbalize what it was. It struck me later what it was. And he's trying to say the difference. He goes, if someone teaches and preaches hatred, before condemning the person, we must ask if there is a positive purpose to it and if it can cause harm for anyone. And then he goes on to explain that the difference is the Kreuzenberger Rebbe was a tzaddik. I never said otherwise. And that the reason for preaching hatred is because he wanted to separate Jews from the non-Jews so Jews wouldn't look to the non-Jewish world and be attracted to it. And nothing ever would come from it in terms of Jews harming non-Jews. And then he goes on to say this isn't true when dealing with Farrakhan and Sharpton, et cetera, et cetera. So I accept that. After all, I never compared them. All I said was that I understand why in the Black community, when they see certain good things said by Farrakhan, it's hard for them to condemn. And I said, we also have issues like that, but I never was comparing them. And, you know, if they feel that certain figures teach them Black pride, a good message, et cetera, I wish they'd condemn them, but I'm saying I understand why it's harder, perhaps. Of course, I'll repeat what I said. It's a terrible chinuch to teach hatred, and you can get the same message otherwise. But I understand. And then he goes on to say that Sharpton, you know, he encouraged the Crown Heights riots and all that. Believe me, I know well about the Crown Heights riots. If anyone wants to read about them, you can read this book. The only book written about it by Edward Shapiro, none other than my father. Unfortunately, if you look, you can't get it anymore. We have some copies. If anyone wants it, I think I have some copies we might be sent to you, but it's a rare book now. But you can certainly buy it and get it from your local library, and you can read all about the Crown Heights riots, which those of us in the New York area lived through them. So, when you make a comparison, and it doesn't mean that any of these rabbis are the equivalent of those menuvolim. It's just that I was trying to set this, you know, put up that we also have a problem sometimes that we feel loyalty to people. Even your local rabbi might say something inappropriate. You feel loyal to them. So it's not so simple that everyone says condemn, condemn. Life is more complicated. Okay, everyone, let us pick up. We're deep into the Rambam, although we'll be done with him in a few minutes as far as these classes go. Of course, we hope that you have a lifetime of learning. We spoke of some interesting things last class. It's funny, I just saw Rabbi Mazuz in his weekly Torah sheet number 199. He also deals with this idea of that the Torah is on different levels. He discusses section 18, why the Torah says ayin tachat ayin. Why does it say an eye for an eye? Why not just say monetary things? And he says that this way, when children are growing up and they learn it and they hear an eye for an eye, it actually stays with them. And if you told them money, mamon, it wouldn't have such an effect. And really, I think he might be right. We instinctively think eye for an eye, but then we have to think, well, actually it's mamon. But the impression of the words eye for an eye stay with us. Maybe that's a reason. We were speaking about the Rambam and views of anthropomorphism. Oh, let me show you this. The language in the Rambam, the Raivad, G'dolim V'tovim Mimenu, that greater and better than the Rambam. I said it comes from Tanakh, and I found it. It's, where is this? Here, in 1 Kings, chapter 2. It's in Pasuk Lamed Beis. This is where the phrase comes from. Asher paga b'shnei anashim tzadikim v'tovim mimenu. So the Raivad uses the word gedolim v'tovim mimenu. I mentioned that the Or Sameach, but not just the Or Sameach, I also found it's in the Knesset Gedola. They say gedolim v'tovim mimenu, you know, had this idea that God is a physical form, naming gedolim v'tovim from us. We had people, not that greater than the Rambam, but that's not the pshat. I do want to, and I quoted the Riaz, as Rav Zeev Trani as also saying that some sages of the Talmud, he thinks, even thought that. I mistakenly said Zeev Trani the elder. Actually, Riaz is the younger. There's two of them. But I want to show you something because this was sponsored last week by the Zoltzbachs. I want to show you something from Amsterdam. Before I get to that, let me show you something else. This idea that God doesn't have a physical form, believe it or not, we have a number of images of God as a physical form. Not that anyone believed God had a physical form, and let's say in the 16th century, 17th or 18th, but strangely enough, from our perspective, you have people who portrayed God as a physical form in books and other things. So here's a sefer. It's called, this is the Torah, Augsburg 1540. Look at the bottom of the sefer here. If you look on the left side, that is, that's God, and it's the creation of the world. And you look on the right side, that is God creating Adam and Eve. Now, this is a non-Jewish image. This is a non-Jewish plate. I know it's a non-Jewish plate for the simple reason is that the Jews read right to left. If you look at this, it's left to right. The first scene is on the left, creation of the world. Then comes creation of Adam and Eve. No Jewish artists would ever do left to right. They do right to left. But this is a Jewish publisher, and they chose to use this on the title page. Here's another book, 1698, Ir Binyamin. This title page has been reprinted in a number of Sfarim. If you go to the lower right-hand corner, I enlarge it. It's easier to see. Here it is. It's Jacob's dream. It's supposed to be in ancient Canaan, but in the background, it looks more like 17th century Germany. But here you have the angel on the ladder. Remember, the angels are coming, going up and coming down. And look who's at the top of the ladder. None other than God. And there's another example I give in my book, but the reason I mention this all is because I want to show you something from Amsterdam. This is in the Jewish cemetery in Amsterdam, one of the Jewish cemeteries. And what you have here, I can't click on it. If I enlarge it, it doesn't really enlarge. This is a image. His name was Samuel. So the image on the Shmuel, the image on the tombstone is God. Remember when God appeared to Shmuel in Shiloh? Or he spoke to him? That's what the image is here. And there where my cursor's over, that is an image of God. And this is actually a graven image. So and this, the other thing's just pictures. I don't know if they're actually Usser, but this should be Usser. It's a graven image of God, unless maybe you assume that it's only if you think God is an image, you can't make an image of him. But this is in the cemetery in Amsterdam that they have this image here. Very, very strange. So we do have examples. We have on ketubas and others where people really portrayed God in a physical form, which the Rambam would be outraged by this. Now, the last thing we were doing, I introduced you to this idea of Ikarim, principle of principles of faith. Can they be decided by majority rule? Can you change your mind? Can principles of faith change? Let me show you something else here. Something which the Rambam would never agree with, and it's very here. This is a Chabad book, actually. It's called Yutes Kislev, and right at the beginning of the book. Well, actually, no, page 54. He says, before the time of the Rambam, it was not kafira, it was not heresy, to think that God had a form. Lo ken la'achar shehus barhetiv shemachshava kazo. He stira lachdu sabara. He says, no, not anymore. And after it was explained by the Rambam and others that the God doesn't, then it's heresy. And then he goes on to say, just like Chassidus, it used to be okay to say that Chassidus is not part of the Torah, but today you can't. But the Rambam is the first one to say that this is absolute nonsense. It never was permissible to think God had a physical form. But that's there's this idea that the Magen of Kozhenitz says that when the Rambam said God doesn't have a physical form, then all sorts of great sages were sent to Gehenna. And when the Ravid came and said that Gedolim v'tovim menu, they didn't know any better than the pearly gates, then the doors of heaven, of hell were opened, and he says the tzaddikim who were in heaven were removed from heaven, and then that's what he says. And then when the Ravad gave his criticism, the pearly gates were opened and they were pushed back in again. But this is not the Rambam's conception. And as I said, for the Rambam, dogma is eternal. And then I said that even his opponents, the way they refute the Rambam is they give examples from Tanaim or Amoraim who disagree with him. And if you find an Amora who disagrees with what the Rambam says, that means that the Rambam is incorrect. They don't say, well, it used to be acceptable and now it's not. And I spoke about the Riaz, or Isaiah Trani, that he uses this as well. Nevertheless, we do find examples, if you look through the writings, especially in Achronim, of where they do decide dogma in a fashion which I think would have been incomprehensible to the medievals. And the most famous example is Ramosha Sofer, the Chasam Sofer. He discusses an interesting passage in the Masechet Sanhedrin. You have in Perech Chelek, there's a Rabbi Hillel. Now, don't be confused. There is Hillel with Shammai, and then there's Rabbi Hillel. We don't know who this Rabbi Hillel was, if he's a Tana or an Amora. Orbach thinks he's an Amora. Others think he's a Tana. So the early sages, we say, Gadol mi Rabban Shmo. They didn't need titles. So Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't have a title, so Hillel and Shammai don't need a title. Rabbi Hillel is someone else. Now, titles are interesting. I think Toronto, I know they're big B'nai Akiva people. We never grew up in B'nai Akiva, so they're going to be upset with me. But I like B'nai Akiva. I send my kids there, even though we didn't have it growing up. But there's something which really has always bothered me. They call themselves B'nai Akiva. Who's Akiva? Akiva's an Amoritz. Akiva's a nobody. He's not an exemplar. Then he goes away to yeshiva, and he comes back after many years, and he's Rabbi Akiva. We look to Rabbi Akiva. It should be B'nai Rabbi Akiva. We don't want to be B'nai Akiva. Akiva, like I said, was, we don't want to be. The whole story is to show you that Akiva, before he went to yeshiva, was the nobody. Now he's a somebody. And why they call it B'nai Akiva instead of B'nai Rabbi Akiva, I've always had a problem with that. But Rabbi Hillel in the Gemara says an amazing statement. There is no Mashiach for Jews, because all the promises were all used in the days of Chizkiyahu. So here you have one of the Amoraim, or maybe a Tana, saying there's no Mashiach. And he's criticized there. Another Amora or Tana says to him, you know, God should forgive you for saying it, but he says it. And he's given the title, and he's not thrown out or anything, at least it seems. How can he say that? This is a heretical view. How could he have this position? Well, this is already discussed by Rav Yosef Albo. Rav Yosef Albo in the Sefer Yikarim discusses Rabbi Hillel's position. If Mashiach is a dogma, how can Rabbi Hillel say this and go against the dogma? In other words, he doesn't say that it used to be not a dogma, now it is. He gives two explanations. First, Rav Yosef Albo says it's not a principle of faith. It's a true idea, but it's not an ikar that if you deny it, you're a heretic. Then he gives another reason, which we've heard already. He says that it is an ikar, but if you make a mistake unintentionally, based upon your authentic reading of Torah, you're not regarded as a heretic. So Rabbi Hillel, according to the second reading, what he said is heresy, but he's not a heretic because it's unintentional. And we already saw that that's a major idea in Rav Yosef Albo, that this idea of unintentional heresy. But the Chasam Sofer has a completely different approach. He says that but he doesn't accept either of those approaches. He says that Rav Hillel advanced his opinion before the matter was decided halachically. In the days of Rav Hillel, you could adopt both positions. Later, however, the decision ruling was made. It's not clear when this is, but I guess by the time of the Amoraic period, that Mashiach is a dogma, and therefore to subsequently believe it is heretical, and it is a dogma, but it wasn't yet a dogma in the days of Rav Hillel, and therefore Rav Hillel was permitted to have this approach. This is the exact opposite of what I said the Rambam's approach is. And the Chasam Sofer compares this to the Talmud speaks about how in certain areas you could do one thing on Shabbos, you couldn't do another area. Or for example, I can give you my own example. He doesn't mention this, but in the days of the Tanaim, you could eat in certain places, you could eat, let's say, chicken and milk. It hadn't yet been formulated as an absolute rule binding everyone. And that's what the Chasam Sofer says, that until the binding decision, the dogmas were flexible and you could adopt different opinions. But once there was an authoritative ruling, then it became, everyone must fall in line. Now, such a position is not concerned with eternal truths. It assumes that the rabbis determine what the obligatory beliefs are. And I already mentioned some of the problems with this, that means that yesterday it could be a dogma and tomorrow you could have a different dogma. Of course, the Chasam Sofer makes it like any other halachic dispute, but it's different in the sense that halachic disputes are about practice. The examples the Chasam Sofer brings, how there was a dispute and now there's not a dispute, you can still think that you're right. You just have to follow the majority of the sages in practice. But here we're speaking about just a matter of thought. So if Rav Hillel used to think that Mashiach, there's no Mashiach, and now they say, well, you have to believe otherwise, then it's really not parallel to halacha because you're telling him he can't even think he's correct. And it does create difficulties. The Rambam, I can't imagine the Rambam ever agreeing with this. Well, he doesn't. The Rambam says explicitly that when something's been demonstrated, doesn't matter how many people, if you look in guide 215, how many people, you know, come to agree with you. And he says its correctness will not be weakened if everyone disagreed. That's what the Rambam says. He says, if you have the truth, the fact that everyone disagrees won't change that. In fact, that's the whole idea of Masechus Harayos. If you have the truth, even if the Sanhedrin says something, if the Sanhedrin's wrong, the Sanhedrin's wrong. Also, the Chasam Sofer's position would put you in a situation that you can be obliged to believe something that's not true. Because if the majority of the sages, for example, were to decide that God had a physical form, what, you're supposed to assume that? We understand that in halakha you have to listen to the sages. But no one assumes that that's true, necessarily, with a capital T. That's the lesson of the Oven of Achnai story. If you remember the Oven of Achnai story, which God himself calls out, as it were, that Rabbi Lezer is right, and Rabbi Yeshua says, Lo b'shamayim hi. And the idea is that, and Rav Moshe Feinstein, take a look at the Igros Moshe. In the introduction, he explains this, that we try to the best of our ability to find out what the halacha is, but the Torah has been given to humans to come up with the solutions. It could be Klapei Shamaya. This isn't what the original intent is, but that's what Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us to do. It's given to us. We don't have a pope who... you know, if we have a prophet who gets a message, the Rambam says, if a prophet comes to you and says, the lachas as follows, because I got a prophecy, we don't pay attention. So it's the Chasam Sofer's position is not really in line with the Rambam's position. That's what I would say. There are earlier sources, however, that agree with the Chasam Sofer on non-dogmatic matter issues. I said this in my article. That is, on just general ideological issues, deciding one or way or another, because, but then you're not dealing with a dogma. You're just dealing with basically how you should instruct people to live, how you instruct people to believe, things like that. But it's not dogma. But the Chasam Sofer's position has become quite popular. And it gets to the old question, is there a psak in matters, in non-halachic matters? And the more you move to the right, the more you find people who want to of all sorts of psakim on all sorts of areas. And yet you will find out, you find again and again, people also on the right wing who'll say things like, chas v'sholom, to say that this is not true. You can't be accepted because the Rambam held it. For example, Rabbi Mazuz has a piece about divine providence. The Rambam, and not just the Rambam, many Rishonim held there's no divine providence on, let's say, animals. It's just like a general providence, not an individual providence. That's Rambam's position. But the Baal Shem Tov held otherwise, and many people say that today you have to believe that there's divine providence on everything. And so Rabbi Mazuz has a piece where he says, well, how can you say that? The Rambam disagrees. You can't throw the Rambam out. To which I guess you could reply, who says you can't throw the Rambam out? If the majority of the sages today say that we have a different opinion, then you can throw the Rambam out. But if you look at people like Rav Mazuz or Shlomo Fischer, all the people who deal with Machshava, they assume that some people, the Rambam, they're so great that by definition, if the Rambam says something, it doesn't matter. You can have all the sages in the world today saying otherwise, we can't get rid of the Rambam. The Rambam, by definition, his views remain valid. That doesn't mean they're correct views. That doesn't mean that we should teach these views. But if anyone holds these views, you can't say that he's a heretic or out of the fold for holding it. That seems to me. So who gets that? Who gets put on that pedestal? Not the Ralbag, the Rambam, the Ramban, the major figures. But I see that according to the Chasam Sofer, in theory at least, you should be able to push the Rambam out also if the majority. Okay, very good. Adkan Simon Kuf Lamed Gimel. Now we're on Simon Kuf Lamed Daled. We're on 289. So we have about 80 pages left. And now we're going into the letters. We have a bunch of letters to Rabbi Mazuz, and then we hit some new figures. I'll just show you a couple other things about Rabbi Mazuz. Let's see. Get rid of this. Where is it here? Okay. So I mentioned the other day, when he starts his shiur, which they do now, in his house, they play Arabic music, but it wasn't, shown. I saw on the, the sound wasn't on, you didn't even see the screen. So this, if you're looking for a community that still tries to observe their old Tunisian ways, so this is the sort of music. Let me play it for you. There's a whole tradition of Arabic music, piyutim, with the Arabic tunes. Now, the yeshiva that Rav Mazuz runs is called Kisei Rachamim, which if you can't count all the branches, it would be the largest Sephardic yeshiva, probably 5 or 6 branches. And they have every year, piyutim, that is, if you have every year, they have a big thing called a hilula in memory of his father who was killed, Rav Mazuz Mazuz in Tunis, in 1971, I believe, by a Palestinian terrorist. And it's at the huge place in Tel Aviv. They get about 7,000 people. It's the largest event of its sort. This year, they couldn't have it. So they had it on Zoom. You had rabbis there speaking, but they had entertainment. So just to give you a sense of how it's different than, for example, a regular Ashkenazi Haredi yeshiva, I'm going to show you a few things. They said, by the way, there were hundreds of thousands of people watching it. Perhaps for what I'll show you, what I won't show you, but I'll tell you, because they removed something from the video. But just here, just to give you an example of, just to show you a couple of things, which I think are interesting, as I said, because you want to see it in the Ashkenazic world. So you could, first of all, you have to watch it on the internet. But so here was the Hilula. It was last month. So the video, if you can watch it for the 2 hours, it's Divrei Torah, it's speeches, and it's music. What is amazing to me, and I'm very upset, and this is maybe why it had hundreds of thousands of people, is that in the original video, which I watched the day after it was put up, I'm watching it, and all of a sudden I hear a singer that I've never heard of, and he's not singing traditional music like this. He's singing like modern music with like good messages, though. And I was shocked. And I looked him up, and it's this guy. I don't know if any of you know him. Yishai Rebo. Apparently, he's very popular. I don't know him. You can listen to his music. He was singing, and for Adi Yeshiva, to have a person like that singing, I found very unusual. But they took it out. I guess people complained, that, but they took it out. Now, if you continue in the Hilula, I'll show you two other things that you'll never see at an Ashkenazic yeshiva's annual dinner. So, for example, here, this you will never, ever see what I'm going to show you now in Israel.
אני לא יודע אילו מהברכות אתה תעדיף לקבל, אבל הערב הזה הוא ערב של ברכות. וגם עם ישראל זקוק לברכה שלך. בבקשה.
תודה רבה לכם. תודה לרב מזוז היקר. תודה לרבנים.
So the idea that you would have someone like Netanyahu, a non-Orthodox figure, speaking at a yeshiva dinner, already you see the difference in the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim, that they have more of a connection to the state than you would have. And especially to listen to what Rabbi Mazuz, you might not like what Rabbi Mazuz says, because Netanyahu's in big trouble now, but those who know Hebrew can hear what he says. You never would have an Ashkenazic Rosh Yeshiva speak this way. I don't even know if Netanyahu's wearing a kippah here. It doesn't look like it. He speaks for a few minutes. But listen to Rabbi Mazuz.
רבותינו הקדושים, אברהם, יצחק ויעקב, ברך את ידידינו היקר ראש הממשלה, בנימין נתניהו, שעלה מעלה מעלה, ושכל הנלחמים בו ירדו קצת, ירדו, יחכו בסבלנות, שיבוא משיח כבר...
What he said, for those who are saying, is that those that Netanyahu should go up, and those who are opposing him, they should go down. So already you see a difference. the Sephardim are much more connected to the state. The, you know, Sephardic families always have people who go to the army. It's a very different approach, even though they dress in black. Just how you dress doesn't mean you're Haredi like we think of. Hey, if you go into the YU base measures today, you have lots of people in black suits and black hats, but they all support the state of Israel and things. So this is important. If not this class, next class, when we get into Rabbi Mazuz, a very important political letter. But let's get to the letters here. Simon Kuf Lamed Dalet. His letter to me, we deal more with Rav Meshulam Roth. We've spoken about Rav Meshulam Roth. I don't want to get into more details. Let me show you a picture of Rav Meshulam Roth. You can read about him. When Shapiro started Yeshiva Slach Me Lublin, he asked Rav Meshulam Roth to prepare a curriculum, which they never followed because it was a much broader curriculum than a traditional yeshiva. He suffered, actually. He lost, I think it was the city of Chernovitz. He did not get the rabbinic position because he refused to give up his Mizrahi allegiances. Sometimes they ask you, for example, I know when Rav Sternbach was given the Eda Charedis, he had to make sure that his granddaughters wouldn't go to Beis Yaakov anymore. But Rav Meshulam refused to do that. But the letter focuses on something else, really. And that's, I raised a question, and in his response, Rabbi Mazuz mentions something, the Ritva. I mentioned that we spoke about this already there. Rav Meshulam Roth doesn't think that the Ritva would really criticize the Rambam so harshly and call his views, you know, approaching heresy. But in the Ritva wrote a book called the Sefer Zikaron, which is defense of the Rambam on the Ramban, from the Ramban's criticism. But for some reason, Rav Mazuz says he doesn't understand how this happens. At one place in this book, the Ritva harshly criticizes the Rambam. And what's the criticism? The Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim says that the reason Lashon HaKodesh is called, Hebrew is called Lashon HaKodesh, is because there are no words for the sexual act and no words for sexual organs. And the Ritva doesn't like this at all. What Rabbi Mazuz says is, he says, I remember, he says that this, he calls this view that of the Rambam I just mentioned, Yesh bo shemetz minut, that it has like a taint of heresy. And then he says, but I don't know what minut is here. And the Ramban, incidentally, he disagrees. The Ramban has a different reason. The Ramban says it's called Lashon HaKodesh because the Torah was given in it. And he says the Ramban quotes this view of the Rambam. He disagrees. He doesn't say it's minut. As I point out in the notes there, Rabbi Mazuz's memory was incorrect. Although the Ritva is critical of the Ramazu, he says, Chalilah, he says, God forbid that I should follow this view and that God should, Yechaperlo, he speaks very strongly against the Rambam. But the word Shemetz Minut doesn't appear here. It appears in a book called the Igeret HaKodesh. If you look in the Kisvei Ramban, this is a work that was attributed to Ramban. The Igeret HaKodesh is called the Holy Letter. It wasn't written by the Ramban. We think it was written by Yosef Chikatila. You can see an English translation of it. This is a book. See, the Rambam develops the idea that this, he quotes Aristotle, that this, he says, the sense of touch is a disgrace for us. The Rambam speaks as a very ascetic approach. His approach in the Moreh Nevuchim is that, of course, you have to have children, so you have to have sexual relations, but the more you can avoid this, the better, and that we're really embarrassed by this. It's a disgrace, but it's a necessary disgrace, but it's not a positive thing, and it's a necessary thing so that the humanity can continue. So the Igeret HaKodesh, the whole idea of Igeret HaKodesh is that, no, this is could be holy if it's done properly. God gave this to us. There's nothing to be ashamed of. And he calls this a taint of heresy, that this is based on Greek ideas of the sense of touch. The Greeks, they put all the focus on the spirituality versus the physicality. And the Igeret HaKodesh sees this view of the Rambam as a completely Greek view, totally foreign to Jewish ideas. It is foreign when you think about all, we always speak about positive attitude to sexuality and everything. We don't mention the Rambam and Rav Avram ben Rambam and others. We have enormous asceticism in Judaism that we pushed out. Rav Lichtenstein has an article explaining, you know, he's being realistic. He's saying, look, we've pushed it out because it doesn't fit in with us today. But you can find plenty of sources. Read the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch one day, what he says. It's scary stuff, I think, growing up and seeing that. Rav Achlesin says that it doesn't work with us today. So there's another tradition, but to say it's not part of our tradition, we have more than one tradition. But so the Igeres HaKodesh, though, is a strong affirmer of the holiness of physicality done properly. God gave it to us. And it shouldn't be viewed. The Ger HaSidim, by the way, the Ger HaSidim are complete ascetics. It's, I don't need to be so explicit here, but Benny Brown has a whole article on this. They are as ascetic as you can be once you have, and for some of them, once you have children, complete asceticism the rest of your life. And don't tell me, well, what about the ketubah says that a man has to do for his wife, because they have an answer to that. They say, well, she's mochel. She like, do we really ask her? But so there are trends of asceticism in the Jewish tradition. Incidentally, I have my own chop on this. If I ever write my chidushim, Jay's Rabbi Kelman's heard it. This is one of my chidushim. I have a few chidushim I like to repeat because I really think if you ever get a chidush that you think is right, you remember it. And this is, and I thought of this only when I started studying world religions. Because you study world religions and you see that Islam doesn't have it, but all the other religions, obviously Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism, they all have this idea, and other religions, of asceticism, of celibacy, because they have this conception that physicality, you have this binary thing here. You have the spirituality and you have physicality. And we, of course, want to be spiritual. So therefore, we have to remove ourselves from physicality. You can't get rid of fancy food, you know, fancy clothes, materialism, food, and of course, sexual relations. So you have the whole trend to celibacy. That explains, I think, though, why we have a mitzvah, Pru Revu. What do you need a mitzvah for? Everyone's going to have children anyway, because had it not been for the mitzvah, we too would have developed a celibate class. We would have been just like old-time Catholicism, where they would have said that for the super pious, for the special ones, them, they do the celibate life because they have to get close to God. And for the rest of us, well, we're going to have families. The only way to prevent this, to make sure that even the rabbi with the big beard and the tzaddik, that he too would have a family life, is to make it a mitzvah. Because if you didn't make it a mitzvah, we too naturally would have developed what we believe to be this phony, false ideology that complete celibacy, that's we wouldn't have had it. So we couldn't have that because it's a mitzvah. But I have to say, if I want to be honest, we can't have that because there's a halacha, but we got close. If you look at the Ger HaSidim and you look at some others, it's not what we tell the young people today about marriage, joining together, husband and wife, etc. Much rather, we like to look at the Igeres HaKodesh, because that seems much more in line with the modern message. And that's not inauthentic. I'm not saying anything absolute, but for us, the message of the Igeres HaKodesh is the only one that works. If you're with the Ger HaSidim, fine, it's a different message. That's Simon Kuflamid Dalid. Kuflamid Hey, I don't need to go into the details. It's also correspondence I had with Rav Mazuz about a certain matter, but I had sent him a book. I sent him this book, and I sent him a number of books by Shaul Lieberman. That's why he thought I worked at the seminary. I don't know, maybe he didn't think I was full-time, but I don't know if you know this book. Hilchos Yerushalmi LaHarambam. It's not a big book, but The Rambam wrote a work on the Jerusalem Talmud, which is like a riff. It's a halachic work on the Jerusalem Talmud. We don't have the whole thing. We only have sections of it, small sections on Brachos, on Kasubos. It comes from the Geniza. If those who are interested in the Geniza, there's a wonderful thing on Vimeo. It's called From Cairo to the Cloud, The World of the Cairo Geniza. And I've been watching it. The problem is I can't give you, it needs a password. And like, if your shul did it, then you can have a password. I can't give it to you. But if you can have access to it, it's from a few years ago. It's really, really very nice, with great interviews and all about the Cairo Geniza. Incredible story. But here you have, and from the Rambam's own handwriting, mind you. You have pictures of it in the back, the Rambam's own handwriting. So I sent it to him, he comments to me, first of all, that it's great what Rav Shaul Lieberman did to put this together. And then he calls attention to the fact that in the back, there's an article by Moshe Lutsky. Moshe Lutsky was an expert in handwriting, and he wrote about the Rambam's handwriting, a long page on the Rambam's handwriting. And in his discussion, and Rabbi Azuz mentions this because this is relevant, Rabbi Azuz is in a big dispute with Professor Havlin at Bar Ilan. There's a Sefer Torah, which has a colophon on it and afterwards that says it's written by the Ran. Not in the Sefer Torah itself, I think connected to it. It's written by the Ran, Remissim of Girona. And he believes it's, Rabbi Azuz thinks it's authentic, and Professor Havlin thinks it's phony. That is that the Ran didn't write it. This is a few hundred years after the Ran. And it's written, I think it's the colophon in a certain script, whatever it is, they argue about that. Now, Lutsky mentions that the Rambam wrote in three type of scripts. First of all, he says that families had scripts. Father would teach a son, and they would teach him a certain script. And if you look at the Rambam script, it's a certain unique type of script, but there's three scripts. You have the square script, like a Sefer Torah. Everyone would write that like in a holy book. But then you have also private stuff when the Rambam's writing for himself before he, quote, publishes his work. Then you have a different script. And then you have a third script where you, when he's writing by himself, it's what we call Ketav Rabbani or Rashi. Rashi didn't invent this script. Rashi never used this, but he looks very much like what in the Middle East they would even write like that. And finally, there's the Ketav we call cursive script, or Melech they call it. So then he talks about the three types of scripts. So why do I mention this? It's really only a side point, because a lot of people don't realize, unless you look at, I won't say medieval, because you look at medieval Ashkenazic Hebrew and you can read it, no problem. You look at Dead Sea Scrolls, you can read it. The people who are with me in Italy were a call. I showed them on the wall something in Italy where you can read it. It's from medieval times. That's not a problem. But in certain places, they developed a certain type of cursive script. Let me show you some examples. And it's... you could see millions of examples of this, but you need to learn. It's called, I think you pronounce it Solitreo. So here, for instance, is what you find in, this is not Arabic script. It's mostly found, let's say, in Turkey and others, but also Judeo-Arabic. I shouldn't say that, Judeo-Arabic as well. So look at these letters. Here, I have a better page here. So you have an Aleph. We know Aleph, Rashi, square. That's the Aleph. And that's the Beis. And this is the Gimel. Dalit, I guess, looks a bit of it. Hey doesn't look anything like it. So when you see these type of, when you see manuscripts, I have to say that I've published a number of things for manuscript. When I'm looking, like I'd go to JTS and I look through the manuscripts, since even you'd see 19th century stuff like that, I immediately would say, nope, skip on to something else because it's too difficult. Unless you, I didn't grow up with it. I have a nice little book here published by Rabbi Mazuz's yeshiva, which is, it's called Kumos HaZahav. It's a workbook to teach you the script. And you can do all the exercises to learn how to write and read this script. But since I'm not using manuscripts written in that script, but if you ever see, for instance, a manuscript of the Sidi Chemed, or loads and loads on the front of this booklet here, it has examples from the Chida, and all these other Rishon LeZion and all these Sfardic Gedoli. And listen, I can't read any of it. I once read a bit of it because I had to, but I had to go back to compare all that. I guess if I practiced enough, I'd be able to. But so different Hebrew scripts. I know that it's strange. Many of us have seen the old Hebrew, that's Proto-Hebrew, which they wrote in the days of Chazalwi, which doesn't look like ours, but it's the same language. It's just a different script. That's all. You can say Aleph can look like anything. Beis can look like anything. There's no Torah Shabbat Peh that in the cursive script that the Beis has to look a certain way. So as I said, we know the Rambam wrote in three different scripts. The next letter is Kuf Lamed Vav, page 291. And this is a short letter. A few years back, there was the great translators you have, the Ibn Tibbon family, Shmuel Ibn Tibon in France, but his father, in Provence, I should say, his father is Judah Ibn Tibon. They come from France. They come from Spain, and then make their way over to southern France. We saw. Hold on, let me see it. I believe for the people who were with us. Okay, I got it here. I'm going to pull it up for you. This will bring back some memories, I think. It just occurred to me. Those who came with me to Spain, do you remember in Granada? I took you with the statue of Judah Ibn Tibon, the father of translators. There, that's the statue. It's right by the hotel we stay at, and I don't think the average person knows what it is, but there's a statue in Granada of Shmuel Ibn Tibon, of Judah Ibn Tibon, because that's where he came from. He came from Granada, but then he went to France, southern Provence. So they're the great translators. And we know Yehuda ibn Tibon did translation, Shmuel ibn Tibon also. So the famous one, obviously, is the Rambam, the Mor Nevuchim. The Rambam says about Shmuel ibn Tibon that he understands my secrets more than anyone else. And it's a pretty significant statement, because Shmuel ibn Tibon was what we would call a radical interpreter of the Mor Nevuchim. He was not a traditional. He was a radical interpreter. Now, Rabbi Kafich doesn't like Ibn Tibon's translation. So you could ask, well, how could Rav Kafach not like Ibn Tibon's translation? The Rambam himself testified to it. Well, Rav Kafach says he didn't really testify to it. Ibn Tibon sent him a few passages, and the Rambam said, oh, very nice. That doesn't mean he, and Kafach says, that from Kafach's perspective, Ibn Tibon's not a halachic scholar. So therefore, the things he misunderstands in the Rambam. I think most scholars, these are experts in the Arabic, think that Rabbi Kafach has stretched this too much, that Ibn Tibon's translation is very good. In fact, Ibn Tibon created certain terms and Hebrew words. He brought terms into the Hebrew language because he needed to translate it. Now, his father wrote an ethical will for him. An ethical will is something people write towards the end of their lives. We have wills where you give money, and ethical wills where you're giving your guidance for your family. Israel Abraham's translated many of these, and the title of the book is called Jewish Ethical Wills, and you can read all these ethical wills. Even the Rambam, they say he has an ethical will, but we know this is not real. It's not authentic. It's at least we think it's not authentic. But what I wrote to Rabbi Mazuz is that in the ethical will, it's called Eret HaMusar, of Yehuda ibn Tibon to his son Shmuel, he says as follows: don't be stubborn to hold on to your opinion, even if you know you are correct. Rather, give in to the Rabbim, the majority, and don't dispute with them. So I wrote to Rabbi Mazuz, considers himself a follower of the Spanish tradition, can't get any better than these two great translators. I said, this doesn't make sense, apparently. It says in the Torah, don't lo sagru, you're not supposed to be afraid. If a rabbi is afraid, we don't like that. He has to stand up and speak the truth, even if everyone's going to oppose him. I say, did the Rambam or Avad Yosef, did they give in to other people just because when they knew that they were correct, just because everyone's disagreeing with them? No, I already just told you what the Rambam said, that the truth doesn't stop being the truth, even if most of the entire world disagrees with you. So I said, well, what do you think about this? How could Yehuda ibn Tibon tell his son, when he's trying to teach his son the proper way to live, that give in to others if they're the majority? No, I would stand up for your rightful opinion. Otherwise, we're going to have majority dictatorship of the majority. And he says to me, Zohar al-Nachana. I said, what you say is correct. In other words, he agrees with it. But he says, apparently, at this time, Rav Shmuel ibn Tibon was still quite young, and his father was worried that he would cause kinna v'sinna, jealousy and hatred, just like what happened to Rav Shlomo ibn Gabirol. It's reported that Rav Shlomo ibn Gabirol, who was so amazing, what a great poet, that people were jealous of him, and when people are jealous, they try to destroy you. And so he said, at least that's, he's giving a suggestion that maybe his father was so worried that that it would cause him trouble since he's young, that he's telling him, keep your mind, keep to yourself. And then he says, even Rav Avad Yosef, in his youth. Remember, I said Rav Avad Yosef, he stood up for the truth as he knew it. He didn't care the controversy. It says even Rav Avad Yosef in his youth, when he when he fought against the Ben Ishchai, he doesn't really complete the sentence. He says also Rav Avad Yosef in his youth, when he argued with the Ben Ishchai Kiyadua, what you need to put in there is that it created enormous controversy. It did. Some people burnt Rav Avad Yosef's book. He was a young guy, like in his early 20s, and he's going around to the various Iraqi shuls and saying, you don't have to listen to the Ben Ishchai. Listen to the Shulchan Aruch because we're in the land of Israel. The Ben Ishchai for them was the final authority, and he was telling them, you don't listen to them. So that created a big controversy. There are people who wanted to put him in Cheirem, but then Rav Mazuz says as follows. When you write a book, you have to put forth your opinion. Yes, it should be, he says, Adinut of Zirut. Put it forth carefully and with sensitivity, but don't cover up the truth. When you write a book, you have to be truthful. And Rav Avad Yosef, I guess he's saying that maybe Rav Avad Yosef shouldn't have gone to the different shuls and preached against the Ben Ishchai, but when you write, you have to write the truth. You can't give in. And in over time, the truth will be revealed because the truth always stands. And then we get to Kuf Lamed Zayin, and this will be the last one we do. It's just a few lines. Rabbi Mazuz has been subject to great attacks by people. I will show you next class what Rav Yitzhak Yosef says about him. But even before that, great attacks, because in his evening Saturday night shiur, he's quoting Bialik, he's quoting often to reject them, but sometimes just quoting their poetry. He likes to quote, he's quoted the Masmid. If you haven't read the Masmid of Bialik, it's such a wonderful thing. I mean, the Rav used to quote this. If you grow up in the Ashkenazic world, it's not so problematic. But today you hear Bialik, oh, the big heretic. And he's quoting other all these sources. So there's a whole literature against him. They put his sitter under Cherem. Here, let me show you. I don't know if you've seen this sitter ever, the Ish Matzliach sitter, very popular sitter, but they change certain things. He corrects the Girsos when he thinks they're mistaken. So it has Haskam here from by Vosner and from other people here, from Rabbi Avad Yosef. But still, in the Sephardic world, there's a whole extremist element that came out of Ashkenaz Yeshiva, so they've attacked him a lot. So I sent him some stuff about Bialik, because Bialik is not just all bad. When Bialik came to Israel, first of all, I wrote the Masmid, which is a great portrayal of the Vosne Yeshiva. Second, when he came to Israel, he wasn't, I wouldn't call him religious, but he was very much in favor of Shabbos in the public sphere. And in a sense, they said he did a certain type of tshuva. So it's not like he's not Chernikovsky or Berdyshevsky, who were complete atheists and heretics and all that. Bialik is much more complicated. So I sent him some things. I sent him how Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, his relationship with Bialik, they had correspondence. And there's a bunch of Gedolim who knew Bialik. I'm sure of David Lifshitz. Maybe you have to meet him. He apparently knew Hebrew literature very well. But Rav Yecheskel Abramsky knew Bialik literature very well. I sent him some of this stuff. And I sent him about some of the history of Bialik. So he writes as follows. And we'll end with this. I think it's a little naive what he writes, but he says, I read everything. People like this, that is like Bialik, that their soul is torn between Emunah and Kfira. That is Bialik. You know, one minute he's speaking very piously. He's calling back his youth. And the next minute, you see stuff, heretical stuff. In one of his, later on, we'll see in the book, Bialik published something that the Russian censor refused to print because it's heretical. You know, the Russian censor is saying it's heretical against God. This is after the big pogrom. We'll get to that. But then he says, Nase Mor Hador, you know, are we supposed to turn people like Bialik, who's Poseach HaShnei Seipim? Are we now supposed to start looking to him as a guidance? So Rabbi Mazuz will quote him if he has a good line or a good thing, but not that he can be a leader. But then he says, Chaval Shelo Haya Hagon Rav Avad Yosef Vagon Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kohen Cook. He says, it's unfortunate that at the beginning of the days of the Haskalah, we didn't have people like Rav Avad Yosef and Rav Kook, because then everything would have turned out okay. There wouldn't have been a split in the nation because they would have been able to keep the people in the fold with their ideas. Okay, now this is quite naive. First of all, there's no question. Rav Avad Yosef has done enormous things. He created a Torah society in the Sephardic world. If you go back to the 1950s and 60s, there's like one yeshiva. He didn't have anything, a Sephardic Torah society. It's all from him. And he created many, many Bali Tshuva. But to say that the European Haskalah, these are secularly educated people. These are people who want entree into Europe. The idea that Rav Avad Yosef would be, there's no language. He doesn't speak their language. So that wouldn't have worked. Rav Kook, it's more interesting because Rav Kook, I don't think any one individual, with the rise of modernity, you're going to have people who are attracted to the new ideas and they're going to leave. But we know that there were great figures. If you look in Germany, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, when he comes on the scene, there is very little attrition among the Orthodox world. And it's precisely due to him and his philosophy. If you look at 1800, the Orthodox dominate all the cities, not obviously the towns. 50 years later, they're the minority. Why is that? Because as Hirsch pointed out, these rabbis didn't know how to respond to the times. They were responding like they were living in Warsaw or Vilna 200 years before. They need Torah and Derech Eretz. Torah needs to respond to the new circumstances. But once the Hirschian idea gets going, there's very little attrition. So yes, had you had a person like Rav Kook, maybe you would have. You did not have in Eastern Europe a Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. If you had, maybe things would have been different. Rishon Salanter tried, but you wouldn't have solved everyone. But the idea is important that had there been, and I would revise what Rabbi Mazuz said, in the beginning years of the state, had you had a Rav Avad Yosef who could appeal to the masses, listen to my classes on him, you wouldn't have had, these people came to Israel. They came from Morocco. Many of them were religious. They came from, not all of them, because with the French already, they stopped being. They came from Yemen. They all were religious. And then they fell into a secular society. They're not secular, but they were influenced. So many of them are not Shomer Shabbos. We know the history. Had you had a figure like Rav Avad Yosef to give them pride and teach them, then it would have been different. But not in Haskalah. Haskalah, you need a Rav Kook type figure. So with that, we end for tonight. Next class, we're going to pick up with what I believe is an important historical document. When they write the history of the Yachad party in Israel, their failure, I think people will use this letter. And we'll hear about listening to Wagner music and some halachic things. We have about six more letters. The Ramban, Moshe Kunitz. What does it mean, maskil? You should shine. The maskilim should shine because Zohar Harakiah. Is maskil always a bad word? What about Gilgal? Is Gilgal really a doctrine? Reincarnation? So we have all sorts of good stuff coming up. Let me now, it's already 9:33. Let me get to the comments, everyone. Thank you all for your comments and questions, as always. I love the fact that I learned so much from the comments. Al-Baruch sent the link. I said this before we got on, that this Werdiger, who's the CEO of the Agudas Yisrael, he goes to the Super Bowl every year. Janine says, this reminds me of modern non-denominational Protestant ministers and congregations. Not sure what that was referring to. So write in. Felix says, where's Rav Avadia say it's permitted to call Isha even if he knows what she looks like? He says it's in the book, in Yabia Omer. In the early Yabia Omer, he says, if you know what she looks like from a picture, you can't. But then in the later Yabia Omer, he says, no, if you just know from a picture, and it's explained in the book by Rav Avraham, if you just know what she looks like from a picture, it's not, it doesn't count. You have to have been with her in person. That's what he says. He says you have to chayim chayosa. So does that mean if you saw her on TV? Because that's sort of like in person. I don't know. He doesn't explain that. But that's a retraction. That's an important retraction. Rav Avraham Yosef explains. We studied this earlier in the course. That his father changed his position on that. Rav Yitzhak Breidowitz is not from Toronto. Oh, yeah, it's Eliezer Breidowitz. You're right. Sorry, I get confused. Thank you, Nat. He's. I think he runs Eisha Torah now.
Darkei Torah. Darkei Torah.
No, in Israel, Yitzhak Breidowitz. Oh. I think he runs Eisha Torah or Sameach. I forget. Someone will write in one of them. Yes, it's Eliezer Breidowitz. And I just want to say again how impressed I was by Rabbi Eliezer Breidowitz, who I've never met, but in general, how impressed I am that the academics and the rabbis are saying basically the same thing. Yeah, they're brothers. Okay. Yeah, I don't know either of them. David Eisen says that, yeah, this was just released yesterday, I think. The Rav Soloveitchik giving an explanation for an eye to eye for an eye. And the Rav doesn't here deal with the fact the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim basically says that it should be an eye for an eye. But the explanation people usually give is that because in theory, that's what we should do. But we can't because it's not going to be... it's not going to be equal. That's what the Gemara says, that if my eye is good and your eye is bad. But the Rav, you can get the link, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you're not watching him. It's just an audio, but whoever set it up so that he sort of moves. And it's in Yiddish. The Rav has a great Yiddish. Yes, so Baruch cites the Gadomi Rabban Shemo, the expression. Piyutim or Pizmonim? No, the Sephardim also use Piyutim, as far as I know. Rav Mazuza uses the term Piyutim. Felix says Yishai Rebo is great. Why did they remove Rebo? I think only because it doesn't. It's like modern music, and for yeshiva, I'm assuming that's why. But Felix says yeshiva guys listening to these days. That's the sort of thing that would be great at my school. Every year they have like a musical thing, so you have someone like Yishai Rebo. We had. We've had all these type of modern, like religious type of singers. But I have to say, I had never heard of him. And Davis says, how is Rav Mazuz blessing the prime minister any different than similar blessings bestowed on Israeli politicians by the Lubavitcher Rebbe? It's no different. But again, the Lubavitcher Rebbe is not a Haredi Rosh Yeshiva. Tell me when and usually Rabbi Netanyahu or other politicians go to the dinner in Tel Aviv. When's the last time you saw Netanyahu or any secular politician go to the Chevron dinner or go to the Ponovej dinner? You won't have it. They'll go to Merkaz. You can see videos of Shamir walking into Merkaz in Yom HaTzmaut, and they sing to him like he's one of the Gedolei Yisrael. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe, of course the Lubavitcher Rebbe would give the blessings, but the Lubavitcher Rebbe is also not in the Haredi world the way we normally think of. You say the prime minister, politicians, Shazar. When Shazar came to America, he went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe, of course, gave him his blessing. And there was a lot of controversy back in Israel. They said, you're the president. You shouldn't go to the Rebbe. The Rebbe should come to you. And they thought it was disrespectful. But Shazar, when he reverted to his youth, he was a chassid, and he went to the Rebbe. He wore the hat the entire time. In his later years, he became more observant, they say. But so they would, all the politicians, including Netanyahu. You could see on YouTube, Netanyahu, when he was in the ambassador, would go to the Rebbe. But it's the same thing. They're not in the Haredi world, per se. David says that Yishai Rebo was part of an increasingly growing group of Jewish music entertainers such as Hanan Ben Ari, who have become mainstream in his music's on the top 10 playlists of secular Israeli radio stations. And the songs, and then I looked on YouTube, these are good messages. It's like there's Christian rock and Christian music. This is Jewish music, but not like we think of like wedding type of music. It's but songs with good messages. And I was listening to them for a while. What is the name of the site about the Geniza? You can't access it. If you email me, I'll send you the link, but you can only see sections of it. It's called From Cairo to the Cloud. For those people in Toronto, the Friedberg, there's the Friedberg Institute, funded by Dov Friedberg. They've created this website and all the fragments of the Geniza. Geniza is incredible. iPad says that as far as Arik Einstein, Israeli musician, took inspirations for Tanakh, including songs about Jacob working, waiting for Rachel. Yeah, okay. I guess they took it. But are they talking? Are they singing these singers? If they're not Orthodox, do they have a contemporary message? I mean, you can have a love song about Jacob working for Rachel, but that's not... And the song Yishai Rebo sang was like about the yeshiva. I think that's different. David says, if the Torah mandated pru revu in order to prevent celibacy, then why are women exempt from this mitzvah? Okay, you don't need me to answer that. The Rishonim already asked that. And the standard answer given is that it's dangerous. Today, maybe people forget that, but in pre-modern times, it was quite dangerous. Many women died in childbirth. If you're ever wondering where you have these, there was the wicked stepmother and everything. Why are there all these wicked stepmothers around? It's because women would often die in childbirth, and the husband then had to remarry to, if he was lucky, he married the sister. Because only the sister would be good, sister of the wife. But generally, they have to find some woman to marry, and that's where you get the theme of the wicked stepmother. So that's what many people say the reason is. Since it's dangerous, we didn't want to have a commandment to require women. Now, how that is actually practical? Because if women are really not obligated, then apparently women, they don't have to have children. You could be married and she could say, well, okay, I'm going on all this birth control and you're never going to have children. So it's a little more complicated than that, because once she gets married, we assume that she is obligated to have children because it's part of her duties as a wife. A woman can't say just because she's married, I'm not obligated and I'm not going to have children. But what it does mean is that technically a woman is not obligated to get married because she's exempt from it. And finally, and the last thing, David says this, or Sameach, Rabbi Breidwitz. I listened to Rabbi Breidwitz. Maybe that's why I said Yitzchak instead of Eliezer, because in the car, I like to listen to, we were snowed out last Tuesday, but on Thursday. So I always listen to good stuff. I listen to her emotion talks. I don't listen to Rabbi Weider. Him I watch because you sort of need to see it. But I listen to her emotion. I listen to David Lichtenstein. I listen to general podcasts, not Jewish ones. I love to listen to Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter. If you don't know John McWhorter, check out John McWhorter. I love him. But so I was listening last week to the David Lichtenstein show, and I was listening to Rabbi Breidwitz, who was on it, Yitzhak Breidwitz. This is just a few weeks ago, and he was speaking about vegetarianism and other things, and he's very impressive and very well-spoken. And of course, I'm waiting, and he throws out Rav Kook and everything. Very nice. So, yes, Morty says, I don't listen to Lexicon Valley. I've only listened to a few of them. I like listening to his stuff on race relations, anti-racism, all that sort of stuff. I think he's great. So Ad Khan.
Thank you. If I recall, I don't know if it connects, you know, years ago, the Aguda convention, there was a whole scandal because it was in Israel, and they refused to invite the president of Israel. Because they didn't want to stand, you know, and you remember that? I was thinking about 35, 40 years ago. There was a whole
scandal. Well, there's been a number of scandals like that. There was another scandal, I think it was the first Aguda convention, or the second in Israel, where they refused to put the Israeli flag up on the hotel where it was taking place at. And they were told, they wanted to take the flag down. And they said, no, we're not taking it down. So what they did is then they put up the flags of all the countries where people were coming from. So America, England. So the Israeli flag was only one flag among many. Yeah, that's they're not going to have. We see the Haredi world. We see part of this with the World Zionist Organization. There was a split in the, there's a split in the Haredi world because a number of leading figures, including Rav Asher Weiss, said that we should be part of this because there's money. And we can direct money and other things. And then there was a strong backlash by Aaron Feld. And even though many Gedolim in Israel from the very right wing said that it's okay. And then how could it be okay? You have to proclaim allegiance to Zionism. I don't think people who are Zionists might not be so happy if they hear this. They said, no one cares. You could just say I'm a Zionist, even if you're not really a Zionist. So the Haredim who said be part of it, they say it's not really a declaration. But Rabbi Aaron Feldman, you can actually see his speech at the Aguda convention attacking this position, saying that these are our principles. We will never be in the World Zionist Organization because we oppose what Zionism is. So the Haredi world itself is split on how to relate, but they would never have an Israeli prime minister speak, unless he was a religious Jew.
How do you spell McWhorter?
McWhorter, McWhorter. Lexicon Valley is all about language. He's a linguist. And his show on racial issues is very entertaining. Okay, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay.